I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Kia ora, welcome to the Kiwi Birth Tales podcast and thanks for tuning in this week. I'm your host Jordan, I'm a mum of one, soon to be two boys and a lover of all things birth and a very passionate storyteller. The goal of Kiwi Birth Tales is to empower, inform, educate and connect families from New Zealand and all over the world, talking about the things that are so often kept to ourselves or shared with only our nearest and dearest because of this taboo that seems to surround sharing stories about birth. All stories deserve to be heard, no story more important than the other, and with this podcast you'll get a variety without bias. The podcast is not intended for medical advice. I'm not an advocate for any particular mode of birth or birth care, and this platform is simply here to share these beautiful, empowering Kiwi Birth Tales with you all. So I hope you enjoy. This week's episode of Kiwi Birth Tales is proudly brought to you by my new course that I have just launched called Mini Kiwi's First Aid. Mini Kiwi's First Aid is a first aid course that is completely online and accessible anytime for parents of children under five. So if you have an under five-year-old, you absolutely need to get in on this course. The course has been designed with a beautiful Kiwi mum named Hannah, and she is an extended care paramedic and unfortunately deals with these kinds of emergency situations that require first aid from parents or caregivers pretty much every day. And she sees how things could be so different if they had been equipped with the knowledge that they needed from a first aid perspective. And she also has two children under five, so she is the perfect person to deliver us this course. Hannah and I sit down for the pre-recorded content and we talk through all different types of emergency first aid situations, as well as some more common situations that we deal with as parents from an illness perspective, and we talk through what the best approach to each situation would be. I get the chance to ask Hannah questions at the end of each video that I have as a parent because I'm not skilled in first aid, although I do feel much more equipped now after doing the course. But I ask questions that I think you may have as well as a parent, and then Hannah answers them. So it's a really nice way to record the content, and then it's all available there for you online. Once you purchase the course, you have lifetime access for as long as the course exists, and you can rewatch each section as many times as you want. That's my favorite thing about online learning, is that you retain all of the information and you can go back and rewatch things and do the course as many times as you like, rather than just one time hoping that you retain the information in person. So really love that about online learning, and I'm confident that you will too. There's a comprehensive course guide, there's quizzes on the platform that you'll do the course on, and then there's also access to Hannah to ask any questions about technique or anything else that comes to mind throughout the course. So it's really, really exciting that it's finally launched. I've been working on this course for so long and I can't wait for you to get your hands on it. I just think every single parent of an under five-year-old will benefit in some way from doing this course, and obviously I hope that you never need to use it, but if you do, you've got the information there, you've done the course, and you know how to treat an emergency situation while you're waiting for medical assistance. And I have included a sneaky little discount in this episode if you've managed to listen to the intro this far. So if you have listened to the intro and you want $10 off the Mini Kiwi's First Aid course, then just enter the code PODDY, P-O-D-D-Y, in capital letters, and that will give you $10 off the course. I would love to hear from you if you give it a try. Let me know what you think. I hope you love it. Hope you never have to use it, but let me know what you think. All right, let's jump into talking about this week's episode, where I speak with Robin about her pregnancy and birth stories. Robin's got quite the journey to share with us. She had an ectopic pregnancy and an IVF journey, so she talks us through that. And then eventually falling pregnant with triplets, which was quite a surprise. Unfortunately, one of those babies didn't make it, so the pregnancy was then deemed a twin pregnancy. So she talks us through that whole experience and what that was like, and then into finding out that her little boy twin had some health concerns. So they ended up having an emergency C-section at 29 weeks, and she talks us through that whole experience and what that journey was like, and then into their stay in the NICU, which was quite lengthy. And she gives some really good advice if you're in a similar situation where you end up with a NICU stay that was unexpected, or maybe you know it's coming, some tips and, yeah, advice on what that was like for her and some things that might be able to help you. So I hope you really enjoy the episode. I'd love to hear from you if you listen to it, so feel free to send me a message on Instagram or to my email kiwibirthtales@gmail.com. Okay, let's jump into the episode. Hi Robin, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to share our story.
Awesome, no worries. Would you like to tell the listeners a little bit about you and who is in your family?
Of course. So my name is Robin and I live in Snells Beach, which is just slightly north of Auckland. And I live with my husband, Charlie, and our six-month-old twins, Cora and Cooper.
Awesome, I love those names.
Thank you.
That's all right. And do you want to talk us through what the journey was like to pregnancy for you guys?
Yes. So it was a wild ride, that's for sure. I expected to fall pregnant relatively easily. We decided to start trying to have a baby once we got married. And I had previously gone off the pill about a year beforehand, just in preparation for that. And both Charlie and I are relatively fit and healthy people, and I just expected it, obviously, to be pretty straightforward. Everyone else that we knew had fallen pregnant really easily, and, you know, I thought it would be no different for us. And so after about a year of trying, I started to get quite frustrated with the situation. We'd tried sort of, you know, timing everything and all that side of things, and nothing was really working. And so after that 12 months, I decided to book an appointment with Fertility Associates. And we went to that meeting, and to be completely fair, we sort of left feeling quite disheartened. And the reason for that being was just more, it sort of felt a bit like a money-making process. And the reason I say that was that the consultant that we have just, she just said a few things that I personally didn't agree with. And when I had sort of questioned her on that, she, you know, told me that I was wrong and all that sort of thing. And so we just left and just didn't feel that, you know, positive about it. But the one thing that she had done during that meeting was an internal examination and had let me know that I hadn't ovulated that month and I was about to, basically. So, you know, we went and did what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, we got pregnant. And it was that typical, you know, go and see a fertility specialist and you get pregnant sort of situation. And so obviously we were really excited by that. It was just a really exciting time. And I am quite an impatient person. And so I had booked a scan prior to the typical scanning that you get done privately. And when I went to that scan, the sonographer was a bit strange, behaving a bit strangely. And it got to the point where she was sort of like, oh, can you please just stay here? I'm just going to go and talk to my manager. And I was like, you know, is everything okay? What's going on? And she was like, oh, I think this is ectopic. And I had never heard of ectopic pregnancies prior to this. Mm. So while she had left the room, I did what I'm sure most people would do and went on Google and saw that it can be incredibly dangerous and life-threatening and all that side of things. And so I started to panic, obviously. And they came back in and walked me over to the hospital. The ultrasound place was just opposite our hospital. So they walked me over, and I spent a few days in hospital basically just waiting to see what had happened with this pregnancy. But fortunately, we didn't have to have any medical intervention. And the heartbeat had stopped, and the HCG levels were dropping slowly but surely. So that sort of continued on for about 6 weeks before everything cleared and my HCG levels got back to zero. Mm-hmm. So that was our sort of first, I guess, introduction to the situation of where things led to from there. And I went and saw my doctor. I started doing, I'm a bit of a researcher, I guess. Like when I'm interested in something, obviously I'll, you know, research and that sort of things. And I started to, I mean, everyone kept telling me that ectopic pregnancies were relatively normal, but the statistics say otherwise and all that sort of thing. So I went to the doctor and she again said to me, no, it's fine, don't worry about it. You know, just continue on trying sort of thing. And because we'd been trying for so long and the one and only time that we had got pregnant, it was ectopic, I just felt like things weren't quite right. And so I booked in with a referral from my doctor to get a HSG scan done, which is where they put a dye through your fallopian tubes just to make sure that there's no blockages and all that side of things. And I went and got that done, and sure enough, my right tube was definitely blocked, and my left tube, they couldn't tell because the procedure itself was incredibly painful, and they weren't sure whether my muscles were spasming from the pain or not. And so ultimately it sort of got to the point where they said that probably the best way to conceive a child was going to be through IVF. So that was really good to know, and I'm really pleased that I went and sort of did things off my own back, because I don't think we would have got to that stage for quite some time if we just sort of left it as per, you know, the doctor's recommendations sort of thing. So we went back to Fertility Associates and we booked a meeting with a different consultant, and she was absolutely amazing. She's one of their head specialists there, Mary Birdsall. She was just absolutely phenomenal. And because we had an issue, we immediately qualified for IVF, but we were then put on to a waiting list, which in Auckland, I think at the time, was roughly around 12 months.
Yeah.
And so again, being the impatient person that I was, that I am, we decided to do it privately. So fortunately, we were in a position to do so. And I think, you know, I would just sort of suggest that, you know, people being aware of the waiting list and that sort of thing. So if there's any concerns, like, you know, get checked relatively quickly and that sort of things, because I know even with unexplained infertility, you have to wait 5 years before you qualify and all that sort of stuff, which is a really long time when you are ready to have a child. So we started the procedure of IVF, and that all went really smoothly. We had a really good egg collection, and we got 7 good embryos. So that was a really positive outcome for the whole process. And we started the process of transferring them. And I didn't really have any expectations around, I think, the first one working. I just thought, you know, my body's been pumped full of hormones, like it's, you know, not likely that it's going to work the first time. And sure enough, it didn't. So that was fine. And then we did our second and third embryo transfers. And these were all with perfectly graded embryos, and none of them were working. And our specialist just sort of, we went back in for a meeting. She was like, you know, there's no real reason why this isn't working. Like, you guys are really good candidates. Everything should be working, basically. So something is obviously going on. And her suggestion was to have my right fallopian tube removed, which is where I'd had the ectopic pregnancy. And this was all happening, I think, in the first lockdown. And so we had to wait until we had the lockdown come out of, I think, level 4 and go into level 3 so that we could get the procedure done. And when I had the tube removed, they did some histology on it. So they just tested to see what was wrong with the tube. And there was this thing called hydrosalpinx. And hydrosalpinx is really common for recurrent miscarriages because there's fluid that is produced that kills embryos. And so this sort of was starting to make sense as to possibly why nothing had been working previously. And So we were sort of feeling positive about it. And the next transfer that we did was a chemical pregnancy. So that was a positive thing. It was the first time that we'd actually had a better outcome than obviously no pregnancy whatsoever. So that was good. And then we had three embryos left. And the last embryo, the seventh embryo, was a day seven embryo, which is not ideal, really. You want to get them to their stages between days five and six. And so we had 2 day six embryos left. And our specialist had decided to, it's not common practice, but she was like, why don't we try with these two embryos, they've probably got about a 40% chance of being successful individually. Mm-hmm. So we'll put them both in. At the stage, we were coming up towards qualifying for our publicly funded IVF. And so we wanted to get rid of the embryos that we had so that we could get a full egg collection the following time round. And so we put the two in. I had asked for two embryos right from the get-go. I've always wanted twins, and we've got lots of twins in our family. My mum's a twin and that sort of thing, and so I was all for it, but I know it's definitely not standard practice. And so we put the two embryos in, and sure enough, we got pregnant. So that was really exciting.
Awesome. And do you want to take us through finding out that you were pregnant and how you were feeling, and I guess that whole stage of your pregnancy?
Yes. Okay. So, so being the nosy and impatient person that I am, I started using pregnancy tests pretty early on after the embryo transfer, and we had had an HCG infusion. So they do this in some embryo transfers now, where they put some HCG into your body, and it's supposed to be good to, you know, get the uterus prepared for HCG and all that sort of stuff. And so for the first couple of days you get positive pregnancy tests, but then it will taper off, and obviously if someone's pregnant then it will start to become positive again. So from, I think, about day four, I was getting positive, day four after the embryo transfer, I was getting positive pregnancy tests. And I won't share how many pregnancy tests I went through because it was literally ridiculous. I was like a little crazy person, but you know, that's an infertility for you. So we were definitely pregnant. Our HCG levels were all good, and the fertility clinic had me go in, I think, at 5 weeks just to ensure that I hadn't had another ectopic pregnancy, especially because we'd put two embryos in. And so we went in for the 5 week scan, and there was one gestational sac, and I don't think that there was a heartbeat at that stage, which was fine. It was, you know, or a fetal pole, it was too early. So we were booked in for the 6 week scan again. And so I went back at 6 weeks, and there were two gestational sacs, but only one with a heartbeat. So at that point we thought, you know, obviously both had tried to implant, but only one had carried on. And then I went back for a 7 week scan, and I'm not entirely sure why we did that, but at the 7 week scan, there were three gestational sacs and three heartbeats. And myself, Charlie, and the fertility specialist were just like, oh my goodness, what is going on here? So one of the embryos itself had split. And that was incredibly, I would say, nerve-wracking to think that we were potentially having triplets. Like, I mean, I am all for three children, but not at once. So that was quite, a stressful / interesting time. And the fertility specialist, she didn't think that all three would continue growing, but we just obviously didn't know at that point. And I think by about 8 or 9 weeks, we went back in and one of them had stopped growing. So, and the other two were absolutely fine, on track for, you know, looking good and all that side of things. So that was, the start of it. And in terms of symptoms, I was pretty sick. I was sick until I think about 17 weeks, and I was on medication, but it didn't help a huge amount, but thankfully didn't end up, you know, with hyperemesis or anything like that. So that was good. And I had just like really swollen feet right from the get-go, carpal tunnel, that side of things. It was quite an uncomfortable pregnancy, I guess, and I always thought I would be one of these FITSPO pregnant people, and that was definitely not the case. I was so sick for the first trimester that I couldn't do anything anyway. And then by the time I got into the second trimester, I was just so uncomfortable that everything just sort of went out the window, to be fair, which is absolutely fine. You know, you just do what you've got to do. But it wasn't that great. But at the same time, I think when it's your first pregnancy, because you don't know what you're getting at the end of it, you don't see it the same. Like, I think if we got pregnant again, I would know that I would get a baby out of it at the end. So it kind of makes it more worthwhile. So,
And so I guess in terms of your care, were you under a midwife, or were you under automatically an obstetrician because you had worked with fertility associates, or what sort of happened there?
Yeah, so I booked a midwife straight away, and we were recommended to have an obstetrician, which I did go and meet with one, and I just really didn't sort of get, we just didn't vibe, I guess. And when I questioned things, I realized pretty quickly that obviously you can pay for an obstetrician privately, and we were more than happy to do so. But at the end of the day, he may not have been at the birth on the day, and we would then be under hospital care anyway, and we would have a hospital obstetrician. And so I just decided that I would go with our LMC and have her, and see how things went from the hospital obstetricians. And we would sort of play it by ear at that point. And it ended up turning out that that sort of happened anyway, which I'll get into later. But we just decided to go with your normal midwife. And I think as well, because there were two babies, and I've discussed this with friends, like the level of care is significantly more so than with a singleton. And so we had scans every 4 weeks. I had done the NIP test, and I had done that just to make sure that everything obviously was fine genetically. But also I wanted to find out the sex of the babies, but because there was two, we knew that there was a boy, but we didn't know whether there were two boys or a boy and a girl. That was interesting. And I thought, because we had scans every 4 weeks, like I would find out the sex of the other baby at the 16-week scan, which we couldn't tell because her bum was down, so we couldn't see anything. So we had to wait until 20 weeks to find out both sexes of babies, which was a pain, but that's okay. So in terms of that side of things, like the care and all that sort of stuff, it's definitely treated very differently with a twin pregnancy, but it doesn't need to be either if everything is relatively straightforward.
And so you went to the 7-week scan, and you had three sacs and three heartbeats. So what was the next scan that you had after that?
Yeah, the next scan I think was it was either 8 or 9 weeks, and that was where there were only two heartbeats. So we could still see the third gestational sac, but it was sort of decreasing in size. And so our fertility specialist basically said that it would dissolve or resolve itself. And from that point, that's when we were handed over from Fertility Associates. And I'd already got in contact with a midwife at that point. That's where we had sort of started the process of whether we would find an OB or not.
Cool. And I guess, in terms of the rest of your pregnancy, do you want to talk us through what your second and third trimesters were like, and any extra scans or anything else that sort of popped up throughout those trimesters that's important to your story?
We only got to the second trimester, through the second trimester. So everything was just fine. I mean, I had all the sort of previous symptoms that I'd explained, and I was pretty uncomfortable. I mean, I'm relatively short. I'm 5'3" and my husband's 6.5". So I was feeling like these babies were just really taking over the world from a body perspective. And I was really uncomfortable from that side of things. But other than that, it was pretty straightforward. I didn't have any issues or complications with gestational diabetes or preeclampsia or anything like that. But because we were having such frequent scans, I think at the 24-week scan, We had noticed that the little boy had been overtaken in terms of size by our girl, which was nothing to be concerned about at that point. We just thought, you know, it is what it is. She's obviously doing really well, that sort of thing. And both babies had their own placentas, so there wasn't any of the twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome going on or anything like that. So that was fine. And then when I went in for a 28-week scan, that was where everything sort of went a bit haywire. So I had gone in for the 28-week scan, and basically I was admitted to hospital at that point because we had abnormal Dopplers for my little boy, Cooper, and he also... he had growth restriction. He was sitting, I think, at about the fifth centile at that stage. And so they were concerned about that side of things. And yeah, so at 28 weeks, I was admitted to Auckland Hospital, and that was basically the start of everything sort of going from there. And so we'd, even with, like, you know, antenatal classes and all that side of things, like, I had started your course, and I think we got through about 8 sessions before I went into hospital, and I'd previously read Ina Mae Gaskin's book and that side of things, but yeah, everything sort of got cut short at that stage. So
And so what happened from there? Like, were you kept in hospital, or what further testing did they do? And yeah, do you want to talk us through that?
Yes, so I was kept in hospital, and basically I was kept in there so that they could do CTG monitoring, which is the baby's heartbeats and your uterine contractions on twice daily, and then also scans every 2 days just to check to see how Cooper's Dopplers were going. And I was given steroids and things like that at that stage because it was likely that I was going to have the babies early. And so, yeah, that monitoring went on for about a week before I had my waters break. And we thought it was Cooper. Obviously, he had been the sort of problem child, I guess. Mm. And when we had the scan, we figured out that it was actually Cora, and she was really, she'd been really low for quite a while. And so my understanding is, you know, when waters break, that you're induced pretty much straight away. And that's normally the case for people at term. And so for me, they just gave me antibiotics, and I was basically, you know, continue bed rest and that sort of things. And the ward that I was in the hospital, it was full of women who'd had their waters break really early. So some people were in there at, you know, 23, 24 weeks. So I was sort of prepped by most of the obstetricians at the hospital that it was likely that it would be a C-section. And that was absolutely fine. Obviously, Cooper's health was the most, you know, was a priority at this point. And so we just continued on with bed rest, and that was fine. I was also offered an amniocentesis test, and this is quite common, I think, in early pregnancy if they're suspected that there's something wrong. And the reason they'd offered me this with Cooper was that he had a little bit more amniotic fluid than what they would expect. He obviously also had growth restriction issues, and one of the obstetricians at the hospital thought that he was holding his hand in a really odd way. And so because of this, they had offered to do the test. And when I sort of questioned them on why we would do that, it was quite confronting because they had used the terminology of termination, and it was just quite intense. It was a really intense conversation, especially, you know, 28 weeks into the pregnancy, whether we would be doing something with this baby if there was something wrong with him. And I guess the tricky part of it was that there was no way that we would probably get the results back from this testing prior to the baby's being born. Like, the hospital and the doctors didn't think that we would get that far along, and so we decided not to go ahead with it. And I had sort of said that it wouldn't change the outcome of whether I wanted to have the baby or not. And also, because we'd had so many scans prior to this, we had seen him moving his hand around in previous scans, and so we didn't think that there was anything going on with his hand. So at this stage, it was just to do with growth, and we knew that that was because of the Dopplers and the amniotic fluid. I mean, sometimes babies have more amniotic fluid, and it's not necessarily because of anything. So Really glad that we didn't go through with that, because amniocentesis tests can also push you into labour. So we decided against that. And that's sort of where everything started to kick off. I think I was in hospital for about 8 days, and that's when I started to go into labour, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what happened from there? I mean, how are you feeling, I guess, from a mental health perspective? And then, yeah, do you want to take us through what happened next?
Yeah. So I actually think that going into hospital and basically being forced to go on bed rest was actually really beneficial. Like, I'm quite a busy person, and I was still working in hospital. Like, I obviously, I was only 28 weeks. I was still expecting to be working for at least probably another 4 weeks.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Before I went on maternity leave. And so I was working in the hospital. My company was really supportive of me and that side of things. And so that side of things was fine. It was keeping me busy as well. And so I think I'd had a conversation with my boss at about midday on the day, saying that I'd hand over all my notes and everything the following day. And I'd woken up with a sore back, and I didn't really think anything of it. And this is probably my naivety around labour and everything. But as the day sort of progressed, my back was getting quite sore, and I ended up having a nap, which I don't typically do during the day. And I woke up and I was like, oh my goodness, my back is actually really sore. And I was messaging my best friend, and she was like, I think that you should probably tell the doctors. I was like, oh, no, it's fine. Like, it's just a sore back, whatever. And it got to the point where I was like, okay, actually, it's quite sore. And again, her and my husband were like, I think you should probably tell the doctor. Mm. So I told the doctors, and they decided to put the CTG monitoring on me. And the baby's heartbeats were fine, but the uterus measurements were constant contractions. And we had I think she was a trainee midwife, and she was like, are you feeling fine? Like, do you need pain relief? And I was like, no, I'm fine. Like, I'm just, it's quite sore, but it's fine. Like, I can handle it. And she was sort of like, oh, the machine, there's something going on with the machine. Like, it was just a bit all a bit strange sort of thing. And so eventually another midwife came in, and she was like, I'm just going to call a doctor in, because this is showing, you know, constant movement here. And again, constantly asking me if I needed pain relief and that side of things. And it got to the point where I was like, okay, I'll have a couple of Panadol. Like, it is quite, you know, sore. And so the doctors came in, and they checked my cervix. And at that stage, I was 4 centimetres, and they could see the baby's head. And it just became a mad rush at that point, basically, to get me into theatre. And yeah, it was really nice. We had the obstetrician came in, and she asked if I did want to deliver them vaginally. And it was really nice that I think that she had asked that, because she knew that that was obviously my preference. Mm. And to be given the option, I think, made all the difference. Like, at the end of the day, I chose not to, purely because of Cooper, and we didn't want to put him under any stress when we were delivering him. And but it was just nice to have the option. And so because I was only 29, I was 29 plus 2 at that stage. And so I was given steroids for the baby's lungs. And I was also given 2 lots of magnesium sulfate. And that is, if anyone's had it, they'll understand it's horrific. You literally feel like your body's on fire. And so as we were going into theatre, I was given magnesium sulfate. And I think that's to help with the baby's brain development and that side of things. And I had been quite apprehensive about having a C-section. I'm not, I mean, the idea of having a surgery while you're awake, and that side of things just freaked me out completely. And so I had sort of expressed that concern to the doctors, and they were all really lovely about it, and, you know, reassuring me that everything would be fine, the curtains would be up, I wouldn't be able to see anything, and that side of things. So that was fine. And because there were twins, they didn't know how long the section would take, and so I was given both an epidural and a spinal tap. And that was all good. And as soon as I had the epidural, actually, it completely calmed me down. I just felt amazing at that point, and which was really nice, because I think it just made the whole procedure a lot more positive as well. So yeah, so we had that, and Cora was born, and I could hear her screaming and crying, and that was all really lovely. And then Cooper was born 2 minutes later, but he didn't cry, and that was I was like, is everything okay, what's going on? And it took a while for people to actually respond to me, and because obviously of the gestation, there was no, you know, skin to skin or anything like that. Both babies had NICU teams waiting for them to take them into incubators and, you know, get them looked after and all that side of things. And I think, like, I don't have any negative thoughts about that side of the birth. I think when you're so early in gestation, obviously the most important thing is actually just making sure that the babies are okay. So they were taken off, and that was fine. Charlie went and had a look at the babies and met them and that sort of things while I was still being stitched up, and then went into recovery. So that was all fine and happy days. We were parents. It was, you know, all good. We did go back up to the NICU rooms that night, but I don't recall it. I think I was just, you know, so out of it on all the medication and that sort of things, and met the babies, but I don't remember that. And that was fine. And then I went back and we started to try and get some colostrum and that sort of things. And strangely, Charlie went home that night, and I don't really know why he went home. It was so weird. Like, we just had these babies, and like, I think it was like 3 or 4 in the morning, and I was like, why has he gone home? Like, this is just the weirdest thing. So yeah, so that was fine. And then the next morning, I got wheeled up to the babies, and yeah, that was, I guess, the start of our NICU journey, really, which was a really long one.
Yeah, wow. I mean, just can't even imagine, like, the having babies at 29 weeks and then, you know, you're recovering from a C-section and they're in NICU. So do you just want to take us through, I guess, how you were feeling in those initial couple of days, and then also give us some insight into your NICU stay and how the babies were doing at that stage?
Yeah, so I was feeling fine. I think recovery wise from the section, I recovered really well initially, and the first sort of 5 days I was feeling really good. I was off the pain medication and that side of things, which was really positive. And I think just knowing, obviously, because they were so preemie, they were absolutely in the right place, and all I can't fault anyone at the hospital with the level of care that I had, and they were all amazing with the babies. So everything was fine. Like, I think it felt really surreal as well. Like, obviously being only 6 months in the pregnancy, I don't think I'd mentally prepared to have them that early. Like, I knew that they would come early, but just not that early, I guess. And so we were sort of thrown into this whirlwind of, oh my gosh, we've got babies now. And that was fine. Like, there was everything was going really well until about day 5. And so with NICU, because we had twins, we had our own room, and that was really nice because we could have the babies out for cuddles and all that sort of things, and we didn't have to share it with anybody else. Like, it was just our own sort of little haven, which was really lovely. And the nurses and the consultants were all absolutely amazing. And then it got to day 5 of the babies being born, and one of the head consultants started to have a conversation with us, and she was like, oh, do you just want to come into this room? We just want to have a conversation with you. And I was like, oh, no, it's fine. Like, we can talk here. There's no, you know, there's no issue with us having a chat in the room. She was like, okay. And she started to talk to us about the fact that at a routine head ultrasound, Cooper had had a brain bleed. And it just sort of took me for six. And I sort of thought at the time, oh, my gosh, okay, actually, let's go into this room. What's happening here? And that conversation continued. Basically, Cooper had had a grade 4 brain bleed on the left side of his brain, which is the worst type of bleed that you can have. And it was horrible, obviously. And we just didn't really know what the outcome of that would be. Basically, the doctors couldn't give us an outcome, what would happen. They just could tell us that at this stage, it was likely that there would be an impact at some stage, and probably something to do with his motor skills. Mm-hmm. And so that was obviously just really intense. I think, you know, day 5, hormones were probably all over the show as well. And it was just, it was a full on conversation. And so we sort of had that, and then we were trying to process that. And I think the following day, his tummy was a little bit swollen, and the doctors were like, oh, we might just do a scan on his tummy. And it turned out that he had had a bowel perforation. So his little intestines had perforated just due to not being mature enough. And so he was taken in for his first surgery at day 7 at that stage. So it was a really intense couple of days. And I mean, I'm a really positive person and that sort of things, but it was intense. Like there's no other word for it. Like, it was horrific, and I wouldn't wish it, you know, on anyone. We sort of, that was a really full on week. And then it sort of progressed from there. He just couldn't catch a break. He had infections and all that side of things. And throughout all this, Cora was your absolute textbook preemie. There was not a thing going on with her. She was happy as Larry, just obviously needed to feed and grow. And so that was really nice as well, not having, I guess, a little bit of sunshine in the situation with one baby that you could focus on when the other one was also, you know, like, it was really awful what was going on with Cooper, but we had something nice going on with Cora as well, which was conflicting, but also really nice as well. So, so that sort of went on for a little while, and eventually he started to turn a corner and get better. And I think as well, like, I've got a friend who had a baby in NICU. She was really, really small, and he had sort of said to me, don't underestimate how resilient these babies are. And that really, really helped with everything that was going on with Cooper. And so they are, like, it's incredible what they can handle at such early stages as well. And so we were in NICU for, I think, just under a month. And once they move out of the level 3, which is the most intensive care part of NICU, they then move into level 2. And because at level 2, they were 32 weeks at that stage, we then moved over to a different hospital, and we went into the SCABU, which is the special care baby unit. And we were there, I think, for a further 2 months. So all in all, we were in the hospital for, I think, 3 months and 1 day, because I was counting every single day. you know, we started our breastfeeding journey in SCABU, and that was quite interesting in the sense that I had thought, I had no preference really to how we fed the babies, especially being 2. Like, I wasn't hugely attached to whether they needed to be breastfed. Obviously, it was it was ideal if they were, but there was no preference, fed is best sort of situation. But both of them started breastfeeding well. I thought initially that Cora was feeding really well, because she had quite a strong latch, I thought, but actually once Cooper had started breastfeeding, because he was a little bit further behind just because of all the complications he'd had, I realized quite quickly that actually Cora didn't have a good latch. I thought it was working well because it was actually quite painful, but that was because she had a bad latch rather than a good latch. And so because Cooper was feeding well, it was really good. We could quickly use a nipple shield for Cora to try and get her feeding to be better and that side of things. So both babies were feeding really well and doing really, really well on that front. But I had wanted to also encourage bottle feeding at some stage just so that I could have help at home. and so I think probably about 37, 38 weeks, we started to introduce a bottle to Cora. Just because she had not been as good with her latch, we decided to start with her. And that also went relatively well. It took a lot longer than I expected it to with the bottle feeding. And I think at that stage as well, like I was starting to feel quite stressed out by my milk supply. So at that point, the babies had been exclusively breastfed, and I was needing to produce, I think, about 1.2, 1.3 litres a day. And it was just getting to a point where my supply was not really keeping up with the babies. And because I was leaving Skaboo every night to go home, I was having to have enough in stock before I got back in the morning to replenish the milk and all that sort of thing. And it was just getting too chaotic, to be fair. And I made the decision at that point to start introducing some formula. And we started with Cora again, just because Cooper's had gut issues and that side of things. And so we started that process there, and mostly breast milk fed, but also formula was introduced at that point. After 3 months and one day, we were allowed out, which was just amazing. It was just so good to get home. And I think the silver lining of the NICU and Skaboo time that we had was, by the time we were ready to go home, I was completely confident with the babies. I knew exactly what I needed to do with them if something went wrong. Mm. And also they were already in a routine. So things, I'm a firm believer that there's always a silver lining with things. And that was definitely it, especially with first-time parents and twins. And to have the support that we did when they were born and that side of things, I think it was a very easy transition into coming home compared to what it would have been had I have, gone to term with them and just come home with two babies and not knowing what on earth to do with them, you know?
Yeah, you do learn so much, I guess, from being in those types of places, right? Like, I was only in the Skaboo with Jai for a week, but I honestly feel like, how would I have known what to do with
him? Yes, I know.
Home?
It's crazy.
Yeah, and so even, I can relate to that.
Exactly. Like, it's just, and even the mothers that you meet in Skaboo and things like that, because we missed out on doing any antenatal classes and that sort of things. And I had only wanted to do that. I was going to do an online hypnobirthing course anyway, but because I wanted to do the antenatal classes to meet mums. And because we sort of missed out on that, being in Skaboo and NICU actually has provided some really great friendships out of it as well. And it's from with mums that have also had like preemie babies and that side of things. And so that's been a really positive part of it as well. So I think you learn so much. The nurses are amazing. The doctors are amazing and that side of things as well. And so you do just end up, I think, with a higher level of confidence with the baby, especially as first-time parents.
And how did you find things once you got home? Were there any concerns about Cooper or sort of, obviously them being so early about their development, or what sort of happened from there?
Yeah, so coming home was obviously great. At the time, they both had feeding tubes still at that point. But both of them used to rip them out all the time. And after about, I think, a week, we just decided to leave them out. And they were getting enough milk from their bottles and that side of things at that point. And because of Cooper's brain bleed and that side of things, he actually despite everything that's gone on with Cooper, he's been on the really, he's been on the optimal side of all the bad things that have happened to him. Like, things could have been much worse with the brain bleed. Like, most situations, because there's swelling in the brain with a brain bleed, some babies will need to have shunts put in, which drain excess fluid and things like that. And Cooper has managed to avoid all of the surgeries and things that have been possible with all of his different situations. So he, from a developmental side of things, we have support. We have a development lady who comes and sees us once a month, and just keeping an eye on what's going on with him and that sort of things. And at this stage, he's not doing anything that is of concern, which is really positive, because he's starting, they're 4 months corrected now, and so they're starting to, you know, do things, like they're starting to actually be a bit more interactive, and now is the time that we would start to see if there's anything going on with him. And so so far so good, and touch wood that that continues on. But at the end of the day, no matter what the situation, you know, Cooper will be Cooper, and we'll just deal with whatever the outcome of that is. But we have a lot of support on that, and that side of things. We also have dietitians coming to see us because he's dairy free, and so the whole experience, I think, and this is not the same for everyone, and this is where I think not just a twin pregnancy, but because of the complications that we have had and the fact that we spent such a long time in NICU and SCBU, we have had a huge amount of support. And this, I think, is what I was having a discussion with some friends about this the other day, and this is the level of care I think that everyone should be sort of given access to, because it's there. But it's just that we've gone through a certain process that we've ended up with that level of care, and it just, we just need more of it, I think. And for people, you know, with single babies, and, you know, everyone deserves the same level of care, because that would completely change a lot of people's outcomes, and, you know, how they perceive, you know, the birth process and all that side of things as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess from an NICU perspective, if we've got parents who are listening to this podcast who either end up with babies in NICU or have babies in NICU right now, I'd love to sort of hear if you've got any advice or tips or words of wisdom, or just something that you wish you knew before that journey started that might be helpful to someone, going through something similar.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even, something like that never even crossed my mind that we would be in that situation. And so I think we just dealt with everything each day as it comes. And I think that that's really important. Like, I think, I guess the pieces of advice that I would give is there's NICU pages that you can join on Facebook, and those are really helpful in terms of, you can ask questions about the situation that you're in, and does anyone have any previous experience with those types of scenarios happening to their babies, which is really helpful. I think making friends with other mums in the NICU or SCBU areas is, again, another beneficial thing, because you've got an outlet to talk to someone who's going through the same experience, and you really do benefit from having people to talk to, I think, as well. And I think as well, like, while we were going through the process that we went through with the babies, there were several occasions where, like, at one stage we ended up in PICU, which is the pediatric intensive care unit, because Cooper had a hernia repair as well, and it got a bit more complicated than it would typically, but we went in there, and it's really eye-opening in the sense that there is, despite everything that we've been through, there was always someone going through something tougher. And I think when you go through these different units, it does often put things into perspective. And that's not to say, like, that was my situation, and that was how we experienced it, and I felt for the people that were going through tougher times, and some people will be in that situation themselves, and, you know, there's nothing that can prepare you for that, and it's an awful thing to be going through when your baby's really sick, and there are really awful scenarios that can occur. But I think that if you, there's plenty of support that's given. They have counsellors, they have a lot of people around to help guide you through that sort of stage. And I think if you need it, just absolutely take them up on that, talk to people. But I think as well, ask questions, because I think when you completely understand what's going on with your baby and you understand what procedures they're planning on doing and you feel confident that you have that clear understanding, then it makes the process a lot easier. And I know in some circumstances, especially because the doctors are often very medical in their terminology and that side of things, if you don't understand it, and just not to be intimidated to ask them the questions that you need to feel confident in knowing what's happening, because that's really, really important as well. So, yeah, I just think, being really good advocates for your baby. And the one thing that I have to say was really positive is that the doctors and consultants and nurses, everybody throughout the units, they trust the parents' opinion on anything when it comes to the babies. Like, they will ask you if the babies are doing anything differently, or baby. Like, I was the first person to notice that Cooper had had seizures at one point, and they jump on anything that the parents say is abnormal. So they really do listen to what you've got to say. Like, you know your baby best. You're watching your baby, you know, the whole time that you're there versus when they pop in every now and then and that side of thing. So I think just being really comfortable with being an advocate for your baby, and not, yeah, don't be afraid to ask the questions that you need to ask, basically.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's great advice. Thank you. And is there anything else that you want to include in your story that we haven't covered yet? Or, yeah, just anything else that you think is important to share?
No, I don't think there's too much. I think the only thing that I would say is that I just think that if you feel like you need more, you know, like, it's the same with like ultrasounds and things like that. I think just being confident enough to really speak up for what you want. Like, it's your body, it's your baby. And I know that this is quite a common theme in even some of the podcasts that you've been having recently and things like that. Like, people, I think, are starting to get a bit more confident with what they're wanting and that side of things. And I think that we just, the more that people ask for certain things, the more likely it is to happen. And I think, you know, there's a lot going on in the health industry and that sort of things around midwives and all that sort of stuff. So hopefully things start to get better, but we can also be the change by asking for those things and I guess demanding the level of care that we expect to be normal for everybody. So I think that would be the only sort of thing, is just, you know, make sure that you get what you want as much as you possibly can. So
for sure. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Robin, for coming on the podcast and sharing your story with us. I think, it'll be really beneficial to parents out there, particularly those who might either end up in a similar situation or have been through something similar. So just super grateful you're willing to share. Thank you.
No, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Kiwi Birth Tales. I hope you have enjoyed it, and I know that Robin had a lot to share in that story, so I'm super grateful that she was willing to come on the podcast. Another reminder that this week's episode is brought to you by my new course, Mini Kiwis First Aid, which is an online first aid course for parents of under fives. I've popped a link in the show notes if you want to go and check out the course, and don't forget that you can use the exclusive discount PODDY, PODDY, for $10 off the course. All right, I will be bringing you another awesome episode next week, so have a good week.
Selling a little? Or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.